morning. My name is Michael McCusker. As expected, Donald Trump has prematurely declared victory for a second term as president and demands the vote count be stopped. Direct evidence he is unfit to preside over a democracy that he has attempted to wreck these past 4 years he has been the illegitimate crime boss of the USA. To quote Abraham Lincoln, if you once forfeit the confidence of your fellow citizens, you can never regain their respect and esteem. It is true that you may fool all the people some of the time. You can even fool some of the people all the time. But you can't fool all of the people all the time. And from our first president, the estimable George Washington, of whom it was said he could never tell a lie. I hold the maxim no less applicable to public than to private affairs that honesty is always the best policy. It has been 2 days since the national election, and the principal position of the presidency remains in doubt, as was also expected. Trump has demeaned democracy and all it stands for, most especially in his campaign to disavow the vote, perhaps the most precious and crucial pillar of democracy. The doubt will most likely remain for a while yet, as it was originally intended when it took weeks, even months, to tally and communicate election results. A quote from Father Adolf Daines might be appropriate. He was a radical Belgian priest who defied King Leopold, who enslaved and murdered hundreds of thousands of black citizens in the Belgian Congo in the late 1800s. Father Daines said, "Remember that you have only one enemy, those who exploit you. And remember, you have only one ally, those who suffer beside you and with you." And now something I wrote, "Divided we fall again." Americans have just fought a revolution through the ballot box. Now we await the possibility of a civil war. Or maybe it's the other way around, or more likely still, it is both. Are we in a national revolt against corruption, dishonesty, and tyranny before we are beset by night riders and extensive backlash lynching? Or are we in pandemic pandemonium? Uncertainty reigns. So does fear as well as despair. Yet desperate hope is also prevalent. We are certainly engaged in a bitter and very ugly war about voting, our most precious and vital instrument of liberation and self-governing, imposed upon our communal democracy by our highest elected turncoat officials, repressive racists, and QAnon Nazis, not to mention religious cranks and anti-feminists. So many repressive scenarios to comprehend. The most oppressive, our own President Donald Trump's self-obsessed determination to remain in office, whether or not he wins re-election. His plot is to invalidate votes and voters, to divide and corrupt the citizenry, to sabotage constitutional democracy with a little help from anti-American foreign influences in tandem with homegrown neo-Nazi goon squads. Despite all of his incendiary fulminations about voter fraud, Trump is the Machiavellian Barnum motivating it. And he promotes violent, white backlash against racial equality. His general attitude toward women amounts to turpitude. As a person who knows him insists, the real Trump is who everyone saw in the first presidential debate, quote, when he offered the most astonishing performance of any leader in modern American history, bullying, ridiculing, manic, boasting, relentlessly interrupting, and talking over his opponent. That's really him, not the myth that's been presented. That's Trump, unquote. And another quote, he has done nothing else that is a constant except for acting in his own interests, says an official who in his own interest remains anonymous. Trump has continually claimed that any other election outcome than victory for him would be rigged and treachery. Now he admits he cannot win without going to court, and quite obviously demeans the vote as that election, as though it is a triviality to be endured only as an initial legal start of a process in which he and his suite of lawyers will adjudicate his right to remain president despite voter rejection. As a final stroke, he thinks he has a new Supreme Court justice in his pocket. Depravity has literally governed the USA since the absurdly improbable election and inauguration of Donald Trump as president an eon ago. He even gave a name to the advent of the boggling infamy, National Patriotic Devotion Day. Since that day he took the oath to uphold democracy, the nation has been a black hole, a whirlwind of depravity and patently evil corruption, virulent prejudice and deceit, most especially the dishonest glue of Trumpian lies, thousands upon thousands of lies that spew from his mouth as lava. Every day Donald Trump, the fabricated fabulist, has hyper-eventilated every day, either startling or horrifying, often both, with an added broth of shock and awful. Trump's theft of the American presidency, he lost the popular vote and manipulated the defective Electoral College, has not only set back democracy, it has quite brutally bashed any semblance of its progress. To such a degree, the nation is in desperate need for a president who will attempt only to realign the USA back to its basic principles, who most likely will have great difficulty progressing it further, if indeed that were an aspiration. Simply reestablishing essential, honest, and decent governance is at present a revolutionary act. 4 years ago, Bernie Sanders lit the fire for genuine populism that Donald Trump confiscated and twisted into his own malignant, hate-fulminated platform when he realized that the Democratic Party leadership was thwarting Sanders' candidacy for a preferred candidate, a woman whom Trump could ruthlessly pounce upon. Millions of working Americans had responded to Sanders' populist platform and thronged his campaign stops throughout the Democratic primaries. He had rekindled the fire of true populism that has burned sporadically in American politics since the Revolution. He was a registered populist, the only one in Congress, both in the House and afterward in the Senate. Massive crowds gathered at Sanders' appearances all over the country, incredibly more than Trump ever has during his campaign and post-campaign Hitler-espoused rallies, not to mention recently. In the notorious Pacific Coast, Portland, a small bird landed on Sanders' podium and became an icon for his campaign. The Democratic Party chiefs should have had the sense to realize that Bernie Sanders had captured the hearts and minds of proletariat Americans who felt abandoned by the American dream and who were the backbone of the Democrats. The party bosses were not only insensitive to Sanders' pluralistic appeal, they resented and set out to crush it, and so they missed a priceless opportunity to meet a truly public need and political demand with a pertinent candidate. Sanders was unwavering in his single-issue campaign, as critics dismissed it, which he had articulated years earlier as the only socialist in Congress. If democracy is going to survive in this country, Sanders said, tens of millions of poor and working class people are going to have to see the connection between their economic condition and the political process. They must not vote for the lesser of two evils, but for jobs, income, health care, and the dignity to which they, as human beings, are entitled. Only when that happens will American democracy be revitalized. And that's Bernie Sanders. Of course, it is long past time for a woman to be president. But even though Hillary Clinton got the popular vote in the main campaign after Sanders was abandoned by the party, and though she could have shined as successor to the USA's first black president, whom Trump viciously hates, she did not especially resonate with discarded working class voters or with black voters, with whom Sanders was also problematic. So they turned to Donald Trump, who disparages women, blacks, working people, and just about everybody but himself. Yet many white women, perhaps holding their noses, voted for Trump, the fake populist. Trump had got the message and larded his nightmarish political savagery with a specious white supremacist perversion of populism that scapegoated the nation's problems on blacks, immigrants, and the mainstream media, which he has from the start denounced as enemies of the state in pure Stalinesque fury. And the venal and unscrupulous self-besotted Trump snatched the dropped torch of populism and ran with it to the White House, declaring a blustery, venomous guerrilla warfare on the decorum of American politics. He aroused the worst instincts of the populist cause, virulently manipulating economic and political disunion with nativist racism and white power nationalism, which he has narcissistically transposed into rampant Trumpism, which by now should be so rancid and putrid to the great majority of multifaceted Americans, they will exercise their right to vote him out of the White House, back into the black hole he emerged from. This retrospective is not simply a twisted trip down bad memory lane. It is about a very real missed opportunity that might very well have spared the USA and the larger world he also tainted, the severe devolution of democracy and decency Donald Trump and his greed-head sycophants and bellicose bullies have brought upon the nation and the world. And that is something I wrote. And as we were dealing with populism, we have been hearing a lot about socialism. So I'd like to read a letter to the Daily Astorian by Judith Wallace of Warrenton. I was concerned to see someone defining socialism as capitalism. They seemed to be confused. Socialism is not communism. The definition of socialism is, quote, a political and economic theory of social organization which advocates that the means of productivity, distribution, and exchange should be owned or regulated by the community as a whole, unquote. Capitalism is an economic and political system in which a country's trade and industry are controlled by private owners for profit rather than by state. The definition of democracy is a system of government by the whole population or all eligible members of a state, typically through elected representatives. I see socialism as much more democratic than capitalism, as socialism is people acting on what is best for the whole population, rather than capitalism, which acts on money being more important than people. And to continue the argument for socialism, I'd like to read something that Albert Einstein wrote, a portion of a much longer paper he wrote in 1949, Why Socialism? The situation prevailing in an economy based on the private ownership of capital is characterized by two main principles. First, means of production, capital, are privately owned and the owners dispose of them as they see fit. Second, the labor contract is free. Of course, there is no such thing as a pure capitalist society in this sense. In particular, it should be noted that workers, through long and bitter political struggles, have succeeded in securing a somewhat improved form of the free labor contract for certain categories of workers. But taken as a whole, the present-day economy does not differ much from pure capitalism. Production is carried on for profit, not for use. There is no provision that all those able and willing to work will always be in a position to find employment. An army of unemployed always exists. The worker is always in fear of losing his or her job. Technological progress frequently results in more unemployment rather than easing the burden of work for all. The profit motive, in conjunction with competition among capitalists, is responsible for an instability in the accumulation and utilization of capital, which leads to increasingly severe depressions. Unlimited competition leads to a huge waste of labor and to a crippling of the social consciousness of individuals. The crippling of individuals, I consider, the worst evil of capitalism. Our whole educational system suffers from this evil. An exaggerated competitive attitude is inculcated into the student, who is trained to worship acquisitive success as a preparation for his or her future career. I am convinced that there is only one way to eliminate these grave evils, namely through the establishment of a socialist economy accompanied by an educational system which would become oriented toward social goals. And that was Why Socialism by Albert Einstein. And he wrote that for the Monthly Review, 1949. And now, from the New York Times, by Farhad Manju. The fury against Trump has begun a great democratic awakening. What did we talk about before Donald Trump? What will we talk about after Donald Trump? Will there ever be an after? And was there ever really a before? One summer day, 5 years or a millennium ago, a boorish TV businessman, a B-list personality with a taste for the tabloid, announced one of those publicity stunt bids for the presidency you usually hear about only in jokey montages at the end of the local news. Then, somehow, there was a catch in the fabric of time. Maybe we had misused our technology, or maybe it was cosmic retribution for our decadence, or maybe just a bad roll of the dice. Whatever it was, that day our collective attention became fixed upon this one man, and there we have remained ever since. We are stuck in eternal orbit around an expanding black hole, irresistibly sucked in. His pull grows stronger with each turn of a relentless feedback loop. The more we look, the more he turns us off. The more he turns us off, the more we look. By the time of his inauguration, Trump was already one of the most covered, most discussed, most famous living human beings of all time. That was only the beginning. Each day since, he has come to dominate more of our lives. Now you hear from him anywhere, everywhere, at any time. He's there on every screen and status update, in every conversation, dream, nightmare. As subtext, he lurks within the arts, in sports, in the weather reports, in houses of worship. For some of us, hardly an hour goes by in which we are not forced to think about the person occupying the White House. Even now, on the precipice of an election that may finally offer an exit from this infinite loop, the end of having to think about Trump seems nowhere close. Sometimes I wonder about the opportunity cost of all this. If you could count up the time and energy we have spent considering this single person, how much global productive capacity would it amount to? What could we have done instead with all that attention? And what do we have to show for it? I am no Trump fan, so I am tempted to say it's all been a waste. I'd like to say that the biggest loss we have experienced under Trump is just this, the loss of our attention, a quiet focus that may otherwise have been put to use fixing one of the planet's many terrible woes. In the closing days of the presidential campaign, Trump's insatiable appetite for attention and our inability to resist feeding it has even become an argument against his reelection. 2/3 of Americans report feeling worn out by the news. If Joe Biden wins, it just won't be so exhausting, Barack Obama said at a rally the other day. You might be able to have a Thanksgiving dinner without having an argument, he said. That would be nice. I am as excited as anyone for a boring president. Yet when I got to thinking about how Trump has redirected our attention, I realized I was mistaken. All the time we spent focused on him has not been for nothing. There has been an unexpected upside to his omnipresence. Even as Trump's presidency has been tiring, not to mention profoundly cruel, deadly, and embarrassing for our nation, it has been something else, motivating. With nearly every tweet, Trump gave us a new 10-car pileup from which we couldn't look away. But in the process of making us look at him, Trump forced many of us to actually look for the first time. By turning us into a nation of rubbernecks, he has pushed us to reckon with why things are crashing in the first place and to examine the faulty infrastructure of our democracy. If we're lucky, this will be his only lasting legacy. For many of us, Trump has shattered the comfortable bliss of not having to pay attention. Trump got us to recognize a truth long ignored in American politics, that a competent government is important. American greatness and American goodness can never again be taken for granted. His inept reign has proved that our country cannot run on autopilot, and that there is no longer any basis for the lazy idea that America will always, in some automatic and reflexive way, work things out. Trump's gutting of federal agencies, from the Environmental Protection Agency to the State Department to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, proved through their resulting failures and missteps the importance of governmental capacity and competence. It is now tragically clear what happens if the federal government is left to wither, if expertise and experience is undermined and overruled, and if honesty, decency, integrity, and fairness are abandoned by public officials. People die. People lose their jobs. Hate and mistrust fester. Long-term problems become sudden emergencies, and the country steadily loses unity and moral standing. It's difficult to remember now, but before Trump, to a lot of Americans, much of what the federal government did would be relegated to an incidental corner of life. Sure, politics was a blood sport on Twitter and cable TV, but for those other than politics junkies, the Obama years were defined by a deep complacency and cynicism toward the democratic process. The midterm elections of 2010 and 2014 and the presidential races of 2012 and 2016 were low engagement, low turnout affairs. You might even say that American political life in the past decade has been determined more by the inaction of those who didn't participate than by the actions of those who did. Obama frequently called on Americans to rise above political apathy, yet beyond his own campaigns, his policies rarely generated mass enthusiasm for the political process. His was an administration of incremental progress, averted disaster, and quiet competence. These are salutary goals, but as Trump would say, they're boring. It's difficult to prompt much excitement about the recession that didn't turn into a depression, the health care plan that solved some problems but not others, or the pandemic that wasn't a national catastrophe. And that was by Farhad Manjoo, "The Fury Against Trump Has Begun a Great Democratic Awakening." And he wrote that for the New York Times on October 30th. And now, by Alexandra Petrie for the Washington Post. "I've had enough news now. Thank you. Either last week or a day or 30 years ago, I'm not sure exactly which, I thought there might be a brief respite from the news cycle, so I got up to get a sandwich. When I sat back down, the New York Times had obtained the president's tax returns, and Donald Trump had bitten off debate moderator Chris Wallace's head, having mistaken him for a bat. Now I'm staring at my phone, trying not to blink in the hope that I could prevent any more news from happening. I zoned out briefly, and in the 60 seconds when my mind was elsewhere, October surprised me 6 times. I hate surprises. I do not hate October, but that attitude can change if it keeps this up. I thought it might be safe to take a nap during the interval after the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But when I woke up, Melania Trump had come out against Christmas or something, and I had sprouted a long beard full of ninepins. Last night, the news came in that President Trump and the First Lady had both tested positive for the novel coronavirus. Frankly, I'm done. Every time I close my eyes, even for a brief instant, something new happens that throws the whole year into chaos. I keep being visited by time travelers from 2 minutes in the future, saying they are nostalgic for this time, right now, before the next thing had happened. What thing? But they only sigh and vanish. These things simply cannot keep happening every day. My fragile system cannot take any more of this. I just want to sit down. Well, I am sitting down, but I want to feel like I'm sitting down instead of feeling what I currently feel, which is that my clenched jaw is on the verge of shattering into 1,000 pieces, and my tense shoulders are about to punch a hole in the ceiling. The experience of consuming news in 2020 continues to reach ever more alarming heights of chaos and surrealism. It has been the moment in a film right after someone says, well, at least it can't get worse. So whoever is stepping on a butterfly needs to stop. I am all set on bombshells. Meanwhile, my own life has been drained of all activity. My personal bar for what constitutes an event has dropped so low as to be subterranean. I have spent non-zero amounts of time cheering on the Roomba as it locates its dock. A bird got into the house in March, and I am still talking about it. Oh, God, something's happening, isn't it? I know it is. You know, put me on that new million-dollar toilet and shoot me into space. Let the meteor come. Let the waters cover me. I'm tired. I've had all the news I would like. I thank you. I am newsed out. As a matter of fact, I am nervous that if I look up from this column, something else will have happened, something equally alarming that I equally did not anticipate. I am almost nervous to try to imagine what that might be, because my experience in 2020 is that if you jokingly invoke a far-fetched impossibility, it will be the next day's headline. The Yellowstone caldera, 6 kaiju. See, I can't even type any farther. No, thank you. Hang a sign on the door of 2020 and let them know I will be receiving no further events. I tried it for a while, this keeping up with the news of the day thing, but I think it's a fad that has run its course. History may continue, but I am happy to stand athwart the news cycle yelling, stop. Maybe if I don't blink ever again, there won't be any more news. It's a thesis worth testing. Maybe if I keep typing this column forever, I won't have to see what the next news is. Stay here with me, where at least we don't know about the next thing, at least at press time. And that was by Alexandra Petrie. I have had enough news now. Thank you. And she is a satirical writer for the Washington Post, from which I read this article. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Halsershock is this program's engineer. Today, November 5th, is Guy Fawkes Day, the 415th anniversary of the gunpowder plot to blow up the very unpopular English king, James I, a forerunner of our own Trumpy Dumpty. The unfortunate Fawkes was caught with 36 barrels of gunpowder in the cellar underneath the king's palace, and was subsequently martyred following arrest and torture. Guy Fawkes Day is widely celebrated in merry old England. Be patient. Whatever the election verdict, we should ardently ensure that life goes on, despite political and pandemic upheavals. Remember, protecting yourself protects everyone else. Vote with your mask and lock down patriotism.